It is time to talk pesky plants this morning. Abby Anderson graduated from the University of Minnesota in 2018 with a master's in conservation biology. Her professional background includes being an educator, an artist, and a scientist. She's on the staff at the University of Minnesota in the Department of Forest Resources. She coordinates two citizen science projects, Cover It Up and Pesky Plant Trackers. Both invite the public to help answer research questions about invasive plants. And Stephen Carlson is a part-time faculty in the Forestry Department teaching environmental education and environmental interpretation. He teaches the next generation of phenologists and naturalists and works on the pesky plants and jumping worm projects. Climate change, he says, is one of the greatest threats to our world and way of life. By observing changes outside our door, we are more able to make the connection between weather and climate, which I know you agree with, right, John Latimer? And we are very happy to have Stephen and Abby join us this morning to tell us about their new project, the Pesky Plant Trackers. Abby, Stephen, thanks so much for being here.
Nice.
Thanks for having us.
You're welcome.
Nice to see you. Stephen, good to see you, my man.
Yes.
Stephen and I have worked together for a long, long, long time. It's hard to believe. If you had a beard, Stephen, I'm sure it'd be gray as mine.
Those are my secrets.
Yeah, well, maybe we should start with Abby. Do you want to tell us a little bit about pesky plants? Who are these pesky plants?
Sure. Many people might know the notion of pesky plants and think we have a whole lot of pesky plants. And we do. So in general, when we talk about pesky plants, that could mean many, many things. But for us, we're talking about plants that come from other parts of the world and cause harm when they arrive in these environments in Minnesota. They may cause harm to woodlands, prairies, wetlands, our waterways, our agriculture, or our built infrastructure. So the plants that we work with in this program are actually just two of many pesky plants that you may have in your imagination right now. The pesky plants that we focus on are wild parsnip and Japanese knotweed. Both of these plants, yeah, go ahead.
No, I was going to say both of those plants are present in northern Minnesota. And many of our listeners are familiar with them, I'm sure. But in the event that they're not, perhaps you can do something to describe them a little
bit. Yeah, happy to do so. Yeah, so both of these plants are regulated in the state of Minnesota as what we call noxious weeds, which means that there are regulations around the fact that you can't transport them and you have to, in some cases, prevent the spread of these plants because they do cause harm. Wild parsnip is in fact related to familiar parsnip. It's part of the carrot family, the root vegetable. And when it invades spaces, it crowds out native plants. But many may also be aware of the real danger it causes for human health in that its plant tissues contain a sap that when that gets on your skin and reacts with light, it can cause serious burns and blisters. So that's one of its most salient problems. Japanese knotweed similarly invades native habitats and crowds out native plants. It can degrade the quality of habitat for wildlife, including aquatic systems, because it commonly grows along riverbanks and stream banks. Knotweed is a really fiercely aggressive grower in that it can even break through hard surfaces like concretes and road building foundations, and in that way can be a real problem for causing property damage.
Do either of these, I think I know the answer, but I want to hear from you maybe. Do either of them reproduce seeds that can be spread and the plant can then grow from that seed?
Excellent question, because these plants have really different strategies in how they reproduce. And they're kind of great examples of two different plant strategies. The wild parsnip produces thousands of small seeds so that a infested area can persist for many years and be hard to remove because seeds aren't, they don't have burrs or structures that really are very much carried by wildlife, but they, it produces so many seeds that the infestation can be really dense. Japanese knotweed, on the other hand, is quite different in that it doesn't produce many seeds. That's not its major strategy. Surprisingly enough, it just reproduces for what we call vegetatively, which means parts of the plant have the capacity to grow a new plant. So especially parts of their root-like structures can, when transported, spread the infestation because it's enough for a whole new plant to arise.
Yeah, a little piece of it will go on and create a real problem. I have some Japanese knotweed here, and my neighbor is an herbalist, and the root apparently has some value. And so every fall, he comes down and we try to eradicate it, but it is amazing how we have dug and dug and dug those roots, and every spring there's another shoot coming back up. So, and I keep running over it with the lawnmower, hoping that that'll keep it down, but it persists. It's a very tenacious plant once it's established.
It is tenacious, and it's just a great example of persistence. It's a very powerful survivor.
Yeah. Stephen, you have worked with me and others on phenology, and how does that relate to our project here, our pesky plants project?
Yeah, Abby did a great job describing the two plants, and the word tenacious is probably the best definition for both of them. In terms of phenology, our work on this project is we are really looking for volunteers that would like to follow these plants for a season, for a growing season, you know, in spring to fall, and really try to cover their basically phenological phases. We call them phenophases that each plant goes through. And we are excited about working with our master gardeners and master naturalists across the state, especially up in the North Country, who have identified these plants either because they're familiar with them, but in many cases, it may be their first exposure to some of them. I know myself, I was not familiar with Japanese knotweed and all the variations that it seems to have. And so learning those plants, learning their location, but more importantly, these volunteers' job is, you know, weekly to go observe the plants and record their phenological stages. And the important piece there is that we then can look back and take this data as these volunteer citizen scientists collect it, and then we better can model and understand how we can hopefully at some point eradicate the species in your area. But for now, we're really looking for those volunteers to study those phenophases of the plant, such as, you know, leaf growth, flowering, ripe fruits, all of those seed drop, all of those phenophases that the plant goes through, so that we can better model the plants for managers down the road to try to eradicate them.
Stephen, do you have to be a scientist to be involved in this?
That's a great question, too. No, we're really looking for volunteers. And, you know, our master naturalists and master gardeners typically are enthusiastic plant lovers who know where some of these plants are and are familiar with the phenophases. But we're fortunate we have a training program with that Abby has developed that so these volunteers can be trained on how to do the observations, when to do the observations, and then how to record the data so that our scientists here at the university can use that data.
It's a pretty interesting process, and I think maybe our listeners don't really realize how important it is, but one of the things that you guys have done in the cities through phenology is plot leaf drop, and then give that information to the city, And then the city knows when they should go out and pick up the leaves out of the gutters to keep them from ending up in the sewers and going into the lakes. But they get the timing right because they're in touch with people who are observing. And I think that's essentially what your pesky plant trackers hopes to do down the line, is to establish this timeline so that when the managers want to go out and do something about these plants, they know the precise time of year to go out and do it.
That's really key. And the, you know, using volunteers like that is to our advantage, because we cannot get, you know, paid scientists out there to collect that data. So, you know, that's an opportunity where those volunteers who are, you know, need to put volunteer hours in for both master gardeners and master naturalists can be a part of really collecting scientific data that is useful for the researchers here at the U.
So, Abby, if I want to begin observing my Japanese knotweed, and I live for the day when I won't be able to make those observations, but how do I do it? Where do I start?
Absolutely. Yeah. So Pesky Plant Trackers has the great opportunity to be working in partnership with Nature's Notebook, which is a national citizen science project that's all about collecting citizen science data. So if listeners are already familiar with Nature's Notebook, you're well on your way, because we work kind of synced up with Nature's Notebook. But even if you're not familiar with Nature's Notebook, go to our website, which is peskyplants.umn.edu, and there you'll find ways to participate. There are a number of ways that training is available to people who feel like, hey, I've never heard of these plants. I don't even know how to find them. So I have a number of resources and kind of training experiences for volunteers to get all the knowledge and the skills they need to participate. And it's right there on the website. You can either take a self-paced online course where you're kind of your own, you set your own pace and you drive the learning by going through a website. Or I also teach, I give instruction by Zoom classes, and that will be happening starting March 22nd. And you can find that on the website if you'd like to register. And then, like I mentioned, Nature's Notebook, because all our data are collected on Nature's Notebook. And I wanted to circle back and appreciate the way both of you expressed the problem and the way these observations lead to solutions, real applicable knowledge, because I liked also the way we talked about how tenacious these plants are. And it really shows us we really need all the knowledge that we can. We need several tactics to eradicate these plants. They're really tough. And so volunteer observations are critical in solving that puzzle.
John and Abby, what does Japanese knotwood look like? Is there a way to describe it?
I'm happy to.
Abby, go ahead.
It's a perennial plant, so it lives many years, as John has already described. It's sometimes commonly described as having bamboo-like stems, and that is, in fact, a pretty interesting trait. It's not a woody plant like a tree or a shrub, but its stems are stiff and they are hollow and they have joints like bamboo. And even after the plant dies in the above ground part of the plant dies in the fall, these hollow bamboo-like stems can persist in the environment. But the plant sends up new shoots the following year, has pink little shoots, and grows very fast. It's kind of remarkably how fast it grows. It has simple leaves that are like kind of shaped like a shield, and grow off. They grow an alternate on the stem, making the stem kind of zigzag. And sometimes you can see that zigzag shape in the stem. And it has white lacy flowers. It's actually individual flowers. They're very, very small, kind of like the way a lilac has a bloom consisting of tiny little flowers. But these are white.
I think the large dark green shield style leaf and the pink stem are really the easy ways to identify it. And it's always I won't say a clump, but they grow, they spread underground by roots, and so they tend to be in a group. They're not individual plants here and there throughout the forest. They're located in one spot, and that's the knotweed. The wild parsnip, a tall plant with that disc of yellow flowers, and the yellow flowers are very small. The disc is maybe 50 to 100 flowers on it, and it looks like, most people don't let their carrots go to flower, but because it is a carrot, it has that disc of flowers that yarrow has. Water hemlock has the same sort of a disc. Cow parsnip, its cousin, has the same sort of a disc of flowers. But the bright yellow, tightly knit group of flowers at the top of a sometimes 6 or 7 foot tall stalk. And in this area, in the northern part of the state, I see it a lot along Highway 200 over by Leech Lake. And there are examples of it up north of Grand Rapids on County Road 325. And I'll have to check my notes, but it's here. And it's another plant that you want to watch out for when you do see it.
Yeah, just you're interested.
Yeah, go ahead.
Just a little addition. The parsnip, wild parsnip, is a biennial. Is that right? And then it grows. It has a small plant the first year, which is more like a rosette. And then the second year, it grows that stalk, the tall stalk. So it's a 2-year plant. And then it's hard to imagine, but the seeds, yeah, they're so prolific that it looks like it's the same plant, but the plant dies off. It only lasts 2 years.
But you might have plants, you might have the rosettes and the flowers at the same time in the same area. So it's not like 1 year they're not there and the next year they are. It's like I'm on odd numbered years and you're on even numbered years, and we're still going to be up there blooming all the time. So if you have a patch of it and if you have these tall 5-6 feet tall plants with discs of tiny yellow flowers at the top, that's wild parsnip. And you want to, first of all, you want to be careful of it because, as Abby said, it has a sap that can make your life unpleasant. So I'm already a member of NPN. How do I go about making sure that my data, if now I'm going to start collecting data on my Japanese knotweed, how do I make sure that it gets to the right spot?
Great question. Yeah, so within NPN, which is the USA National Phenology Network, when you're using Nature's Notebook to collect data on either of these species, it's because you've told the Nature's Notebook and NPN what species you're tracking that the data will be part of the project. Actually, one of the really cool things about NPN in general and about citizen science is it's really amazing. Any data collected by any citizen scientist become publicly available. And so ours is just kind of like a project that's nested within this tremendously valuable data set that NPN makes possible. I would also recommend that you sign up for the newsletter because I like to communicate with volunteers and give them tips and opportunities and resources. So you can sign up for the newsletter that I send, and that's by signing up on the website.
And once again, that address is?
peskyplants.umn.edu.
We are almost out of time, but Abby and Stephen, what's success look like for you guys when it comes to this pesky plant trackers?
So Abby, you go first.
Great, I'm happy to. Well, it's interesting because I work with volunteers, so I think of success as two kinds. Like, of course, I want the data and I want to give my fellow researchers the data they need to make high quality models and reduce our uncertainty around these plants. But as an educator, I also want to help people feel confident in interpreting the world around them and be safe around plants that can be potentially dangerous.
Yeah, I'd like to support that idea that we give people a set of skills that then they can better understand all of what's going on around them, not just on these two species, but the variety of plants and animals that are outside their back door.
That's Stephen Carlson along with Abby Anderson. They've been telling us about Pesky Plants, their project. You can find more information at peskyplants.umn.edu. Thanks so much. We hope to check in with you another time.
I'd love that. This has been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, good to see you both of you. Thank you for joining us on the radio. I realize that not everyone got to see your smiling faces this morning, but they got to hear your wonderful information. And I hope that some of you out there will go check out that website. We will post that on our website and our Season Watch page and continue to do that so that if you want to get involved in this citizen science project, you'll know the way.
That's right. You can find all that information at kaxe.org. This interview will be available later today at our website.